Okay, thank you very much for having me. So I apologize at the beginning. This is the worst type of talk. I've been giving a talk sort of like this and then updating it for a while. And then I keep putting all the really cool recent stuff at the end. So I'm going to barrel through a bunch of material and then get to the stuff at the end, which I don't have slides prepared for because I haven't yet figured out how to prepare slides for it. But this is going to be a talk basically about various things that you can do with data sets. Here, data sets are cosmic microwave background maps. Here's a picture of a cosmic microwave background map. And data sets will also be galaxy surveys and also future 21 centimeter surveys, surveys of the Apakah reionization and the distribution of neutral hydrogen during the dark ages before the Apakah reionization. Oh, I got to go over here, I guess. So I'm going to start with the cosmic microwave background. The cosmic microwave background is a map of the temperature as a function of position had on the sky. And with WMAP, we've got an order of a million pixels on the sky. With Planck, we'll have a factor of 10 or so more pixels. So we actually have these maps. This is not a fantasy. These are huge and very precise data sets. And the question is, what can we do with them? So the most popular thing to do, or the first order thing that you do, is measure the power spectrum. So the way you measure the power spectrum is you take the temperature map, which is a function of position on the sky being a two-sphere. I convert that two-sphere into spherical harmonic coefficients. This is the spherical equivalent of a Fourier transform. So these are sort of Fourier representation of that temperature map. These ALMs depend on the coordinate system. If I choose the z-axis to be over there as opposed to over there, then these different the precise values of the ALMs change. But if I sum over all values of m associated with a given value of little l, then this quantity, C sub l, is a rotational invariant, and that's the power spectrum. The variance of the temperature distribution, delta T squared, is a sum over all l of this power spectrum. So it's more or less the area under the curve of the power spectrum when I plot it. If I have a map, which I do, if these ALMs are measured from experiment, then I measure the power spectrum by summing over all the ALM squared for a given value of L, and then dividing by 2L plus 1. So C sub L is the mean value of ALM squared. And when you actually make the measurement, this is what it looks like. So here we plot the power spectrum from L equals 2 to L equals a few thousand. As we go from left to right, we're going to higher multiple moment or higher Fourier number. And therefore, as we go from the right to the left, we're going from small angular scales to large angular scales. So here, the wavelength of the fluctuations at L of 1,000 is about a fifth of a degree. At L of about 200, it's about 1 degree. And 90 degrees is at L equals 2, the quadrupole. And we've measured it very precisely, and there are lots of things that you can do. Just to remind you, the interpretation of this is that we are looking at primordial density perturbations like those predicted by inflation. So without going into details, the structure of this power spectrum, the bumps and wiggles, are very, very close to what you would expect, as close as or consistent, very precisely consistent, with what you would expect from a scale invariant spectrum of primordial adiabatic perturbations, such as those predicted by inflation. So what we surmise is that at some period in the early history of the universe, the energy density of the universe was dominated by the vacuum energy associated with the displacement of some scalar field from the minimum of its potential. And if you have some new scalar field that is displaced from the minimum of its potential sometime in the early history of the universe, then you can actually give rise to a homogeneous, nearly flat universe like the one that we see with a nearly scale invariant spectrum of density perturbations. Those density perturbations arise in inflation as quantum fluctuations in the scalar field. So the scalar field during inflation is to a first approximation homogeneous, takes on the same value everywhere. But even in a vacuum, there will be quantum fluctuations, zero-point oscillations in the scalar field. If the scalar field oscillates up somewhere, then the density of the universe will be higher in that region of the universe. And if it oscillates down, then the density in that region of the universe will be lower. So it is believed that these temperature fluctuations that we see with WMAP are actually quantum fluctuations of the inflaton during inflation. So During inflation, each Fourier mode of the scalar field satisfies a simple harmonic oscillator-like equation of motion. That means that the amplitudes phi sub k for each Fourier mode should be drawn from a Gaussian distribution. And since each Fourier mode is uncoupled from every other Fourier mode, there's a separate equation of motion for each Fourier mode, the amplitude of each Fourier mode of each phi sub k is independent of every other phi sub k. So that means that we expect phi, the primordial scalar field perturbation, to be a realization of a Gaussian random field. When we go to the sphere, when we map that three-dimensional distribution and take a two-dimensional spherical size of that three-dimensional distribution, that Gaussianity is made manifest in the following way. The expectation value for the product of any two different ALMs averaged over all realizations of that random field are zero if L and M and L prime and M prime differ. So this statement says that the expectation value of ALM squared is the power spectrum C sub L, which we've seen before, but it also says that all of the different spherical harmonic coefficients are statistically independent. The expectation value for the product of any two is zero unless L is equal to M prime, L prime, and M is equal to M prime. There's also no M dependence. The fact that there's no M dependence, this expectation value depends only on L, is a consequence of statistical isotropy. There is no preferred direction on the sky. A quick review of old news. If you know the values of all of these cosmological parameters or assume the values of all the cosmological parameters, it's straightforward to predict what the shapes of these power spectra look like, where the bumps and wiggles go, how high they are, etc. But the heights of the bumps and wiggles and their locations, etc., depend on cosmological parameters like omega, baryon density, the Hubble parameter, cosmological constant, etc. And so if you measure these bumps and wiggles very precisely, since there are many features in these power spectra, you can actually simultaneously fit for a ton of different cosmological parameters, and this has now been done, as you've seen. So now we know dark matter density, the baryon density, the cosmological constant, the Hubble constant, et cetera, to several significant figures. This used to be a much more fun field than it is now. When I was a graduate student, you had cosmic streams, you had topological defects, you had primordial baryon isocurvature models. Anything went, and it was all okay. Anyway, that's the power spectrum. Yep?
You still have to explain what dark energy is.
I still have to explain what dark energy is?
Somebody does.
Nobody told me that I need to explain what dark energy is before I get my reimbursement. Is that part of the deal?
The
meat
eye within the week.
Okay. So anyway, the question is, what else can we do with this data set? We spend a lot of money, we spend a lot of time. It's there, the power spectrum, that's great, that's wonderful, but is there anything else we can do? So there's the polarization. Again, what I'm going to tell you at first is semi-old news. So in addition to measuring the temperature at each point in the sky, you also measure the linear polarization. So the linear polarization at each point in the sky is represented by a polarization factor that has some orientation and also has some magnitude depending on the size of the polarization or the magnitude of the polarization. Roughly speaking, we represent the temperature map. T is a function of N as a scalar field, the temperature. We represent a polarization map, very roughly speaking, as a polarization vector field, or as the cognoscenti in the audience will tell you, a spin 2 field. And a vector field or spin 2 field can always be written as the gradient of some scalar field plus the curl of some other vector field. And so one can geometrically decompose the polarization map that is measured into a curl-free and curl component, or an E-mode and a B-mode. And since density perturbations are scalar perturbations, they have no handedness, they cannot produce a polarization pattern with a curl. But gravitational waves do have a handedness. They can come as right or left circularly polarized gravitational waves. And so you can show that they do produce a polarization pattern with a curl. So one thing that many people are trying to do now is to measure the polarization to see whether there's a curl or not. And if there's a curl, then we've discovered gravitational waves. And that's a good thing because inflation predicts gravitational waves. Here's an artist's rendition of E modes and B modes. So E modes are a polarization pattern that have no handedness. If I look at this in a mirror, it looks the same. If I look at this in a mirror, it looks the same. But if I look at this in the mirror, it looks like this, and vice versa. So these are two examples of polarization patterns that have handedness. Those are what B modes look like. With the temperature, I have measured a power spectrum, C sub L, TT. But now, if I have three quantities, or three fields, T, E, and B, to describe the combined temperature polarization map, then there are most generally six two-point correlation functions, or equivalently six power spectra, TT, EE, BB, TE, TB, and EB. TB and EB are parity breaking. Right? If I have a correlation between an E mode and a B mode, and then I look at that field in a mirror, that correlation will have the opposite sign. This will look like this correlated with this. So if I have an EB correlation, that can only arise if the physics giving rise to the temperature polarization map exhibits parity breaking. And the same thing is true for TB. So if I believe that the new physics responsible for generating these primordial perturbations is parity conserving, then I expect these power spectra to be zero. But of course, if I have the map, this is something that I can measure. I can go to the map and I can measure the correlation between the E modes and the B modes, and also between the T modes and the B modes. So this measurement of these two power spectra gives me a way to test or look for parity breaking physics in the early universe. So this is one thing that you can do. You can look for parity breaking by measuring C sub L EB and C sub L TB. And one mechanism that allows you to actually produce a parity breaking signal is cosmological birefringence. This is something that takes place not necessarily in the early universe, but in the late universe. And the motivation comes from quintessence. I have to explain dark energy. So if I'm going to explain dark energy, one possibility is that I have a scalar field phi with a very nearly flat potential. A very good guess for a scalar field with a very nearly flat potential is that it's a pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson of some new theory with an otherwise unbroken U1 gauge symmetry. So if I do have phi, some scalar field that is axion-like, that couples to the pseudo-scalar of electromagnetism, then, roughly speaking, the Lagrangian is the usual F squared term, which I write as 1 half E squared minus B squared, plus another term, which is phi FF dual, which in terms of the component fields is E dot B. So, as you learn, FF dual or E dot B in a Lagrangian, if multiplied by a constant, if this phi is a constant, has no classical consequences, does not affect the classical equations of motion because it can be written as the total derivative. But if the thing multiplying FF dual evolves in time, then that term is no longer a total derivative, and it can actually have consequences that are manifest in the classical equations of motion. So for those of you who are teaching graduate-level electrodynamics, this is a Maxwell-level homework problem. You can ask, what happens if I modify the Lagrangian by a term that looks like this, where phi, the scalar field or parameter, is something that evolves in time? And what you find is that the Klein-Gordon equation for right polarized electromagnetic waves is different than the Klein-Gordon equation for left polarized electromagnetic waves. So right and left circularly polarized electromagnetic waves propagate at slightly different velocities, and a linear polarization is a linear combination of a right and left circular polarization. And if those two things have slightly different frequencies, then that gives rise to a beat phenomenon, which is the rotation of the linear polarization. This is analogous to Faraday rotation, except that this is a frequency independent effect as opposed to Faraday rotation, which has a very rapid frequency dependence. So what happens is that if you have such a term, if you have some new scalar field, there's coupled electromagnetism in this way, and phi is evolving in time, then the evolution of phi with time leads to rotation by an angle alpha equal delta phi divided by m star, this mass parameter over here, of the polarization of photons as they propagate from the surface of last scatter to us. Yep?
Coming from the non-linearity of 3D. Are those that play a role in the external magnetic field in the early universe?
Not in this way, because those terms that come across in QED, the higher order terms in QED are E squared minus B squared quantity squared.
No, there's also E dot B squared.
E dot B squared. Yeah, E dot B squared does not do this, because E dot B squared is parity even. So, What happens if I draw a picture is the following. So suppose I have a primordial polarization pattern that looks like these purple lines over here, and then I rotate the polarization vector at each point in the sky by the same amount, alpha. In that case, I observe these red lines instead of the purple lines. But the red lines are all rotated from the purple lines by the same angle alpha anywhere, everywhere. So whatever long-range correlations are imprinted in the blue lines will be preserved in the red lines. Now going back a few slides, if I take an E mode and rotate the polarization by 45 degrees to the right everywhere, then I get this B mode and vice versa. So if I have an E mode, if I start with an E mode and rotate slightly, I introduce a small component of B mode. But if that B mode is obtained by rotating the E mode everywhere, then the long range correlations that were initially imprinted in the EE correlations in the blue lines will be imprinted in the EB correlations in the rotated lines. So you can look for this EB cross correlation, and this is an analysis that has now been done by WMAP as well as several fairly powerful ground-based experiments like Quad in particular is very good for this. And we now know empirically that the CMB polarization pattern that we see was not rotated with an alpha any greater than a few degrees. So we know that alpha is less than about a degree. And I claim, for those of you who are interested in precision tests of the standard of a precision test of fundamental physics, this tells us that right and left circularly polarized electromagnetic waves propagate through the universe with the same velocity to 1 part in 10 to the 30th. Yes, it has to be experimentally greater than about 100 times delta phi. I have no theoretical. You can write down various Lagrangians and plug in numbers, but I don't have any theories. No, I don't. I don't have a theoretical preference. So, what else can we do? There are also departures from Gaussianity and statistical isotropy. You probably hear a lot about non-Gaussianity. You've probably heard a bit about departures from statistical isotropy, although less. So, just to remind you, the inflationary prediction is that the temperature pattern is a Gaussian random field, so that these ALMs are statistically independent. No two ALMs that differ are correlated. But that prediction can be modified by a number of physical effects. There are late time effects. For example, gravitational lensing breaks the statistical independence of these different ALMs. There might be new inflationary physics beyond the pure vanilla inflation, for example, non-Gaussianity, higher order interactions, etc. And then there are also other late time or early time exotic effects that can modify the statistical independence of the different ALMs. So most generally, if I do not respect statistical isotropy, the most general covariance between any two different ALMs can be written as the lowest order statistically isotropic thing plus another term, which is a sum over all values of capital L and capital M of some new coefficients, which we call bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients, which have these capital LM indices and then the small LL prime indices, times a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. So what this is saying is that the most general covariance between any two different spherical harmonic coefficients or any two angular momentum states, Lm and L prime M prime, can be written as the sum over total angular momentum states, capital L, capital M. So there's no physics here. This is just the most general expansion of the product of Alm, Al prime, M prime, written not in terms of Lm, L prime, M prime, but in written in terms of these bipolar spherical harmonics in a basis in which the quantum numbers are Lm, little L prime. So if I have a theory that violates statistical isotropy in some way, that theory will make a prediction for these bipolar spherical harmonics. If I have a map of the cosmic microwave background, if these ALMs are obtained from data, if I go to the WMAP website and find out what they are, I can measure these bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients by just summing over all L's. There's a typo there. There should be no M and no M prime there. No L and no L prime there. I sum over all M, M prime of the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient times these things. and that gives me my measurement of the bipolar spherical harmonic coefficient. So there's a straightforward recipe for measuring these things from the data. So one non-exotic example of something that induces bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients is weak gravitational lensing. And weak gravitational lensing is something that actually happens, not only that we think happens, it has now been detected by several different groups. So in the absence of gravitational lensing, some part of the CMB sky might look something like this. There are hot and cold spots, but more or less it looks like noise, a noise power spectrum everywhere, and a statistically isotropic noise power spectrum. But if I were to gravitationally lens that by, for example, a galaxy cluster, then what I might see is something that looks like this. So this actually has the same two-point correlation function or the same power spectrum as this map does, to a very good approximation, but your eye tells you that this is clearly different than this. And the point of bipolar spherical harmonics is to provide a mathematical algorithm for doing what your eye does. And just to show you that it's a straightforward recipe, if I do have gravitational lensing implies that the point on the sky from which a photon comes is actually deflected by a deflection angle alpha. And in gravitational lensing, that deflection field alpha can always be written as the gradient of some projected potential phi. And in that case, I can take phi and decompose it into spherical harmonic coefficients phi lm, and then this formula gives me the prediction for the bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients in terms of the projected potential spherical harmonic coefficients, which are given in terms of the projected potential, which in turn describes the deflection angle. So there's a straightforward recipe for predicting or calculating the bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients induced by any deflection pattern. So this has now been detected through cross-correlation with galaxy surveys by two groups about 4 or 5 years ago now. And in 2010, about a year and a half ago, this was detected with SPT and ACT without the benefit of the galaxy surveys. So you actually can detect the distortion of lensing of the CMB by looking at the CMB by itself. Actually, there's another more recent SPT detection as well, in addition to this ACT detection. So here's an example of some new exotic physics that will also give rise to bipolar spherical harmonics. So in inflation, the simplest single-field slow-roll models for inflation predict that the universe is statistically isotropic and homogeneous. Although there are density perturbations everywhere, those density perturbations don't point in some specific direction, and they're the same, roughly speaking, in this region of the universe as they are in this region of the universe. In particular, statistical isotropy says that the power spectrum does not depend on the direction. The Fourier modes that make up the density field, say, in the z direction, have the same amplitude as the Fourier modes, say, in the x, y, and all other directions. But that is a prediction, and it's a prediction that we've always assumed to be true, but now with this precise data, it's actually a prediction that can be tested quantitatively. So this was work that I did with Anthony Pullen a few years ago. He's a graduate student who's now a postdoc at JPL. There are a lot of equations in the paper. I'm going to skip all the equations. But in words, what we did is we developed a family of models that departed from statistical isotropy, but that were parameterized by some parameter, epsilon, which in the limit that epsilon goes to zero becomes a statistically isotropic theory. And then what we did is we wrote down the bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients induced by this various departure from statistical isotropy, and then figured out how well you could actually measure those departures from statistical isotropy from a CMB map. So again, a picture is worth a lot of words. Roughly speaking, what we're thinking of or what we're looking for are distortions of the cosmic microwave background that look something like this as opposed to this. Oh, I should point out, there have actually been papers written on inflationary models that would produce such departures from statistical isotropy. And one of the papers that inspired us to look at this was a paper by Ackerman, Carroll, and Wise. And that paper predicted that there would be a CMB, that there would be a power quadrupole. So what that prediction is that the CMB temperature map would look more like this. So again, here's a statistically isotropic simulation. There are temperature fluctuations everywhere, but the temperature fluctuations have roughly the same amplitude everywhere. Here's a simulation of a sky that has a power quadrupole. So there are temperature fluctuations everywhere, but the amplitude of the temperature fluctuations is smaller at the poles than it is at the equator. So this is an example of a power quadrupole. And again, your eye can see that there's a difference between this and this. Your eye can see that there's a variation in the power amplitude as they go from the North Pole through the equator down to the South Pole. And again, bipolar spherical harmonics are a mathematical formalism designed to look, to do what your eye and what your brain do intuitively. Here's another example, a power dipole. Adrian and I wrote some papers with various other collaborators. So again, you can look for a power dipole with bipolar spherical harmonics. There is actually a claim that there is a power dipole in our CMB sky. People argue about whether it's a 3.1 sigma effect or a 2.9 sigma effect. Greater than 3 sigma effect is victory. Less than 3 sigma effect is not. Anyway, there does seem to be a power dipole in our sky. Whether it's a statistically significant or whether it means anything remains to be determined.
Wasn't there a claim for a power quadrupole?
So the claim for the power quadrupole, so people did find a power quadrupole, but it was frequency dependent. So it's an intensity power quadrupole that they detected. It's not believed to be a CMB power quadrupole.
But the dipole one is frequency dependent, and is that 3 sigma? I didn't realize.
Yeah. Well, it depends on who's sigmas. So another thing that you could look for with bipolar spherical harmonics are spatial variations of cosmological parameters. So suppose the cosmological parameters over here were different than over here. So suppose the baryon density, the dark matter density was slightly different over here than it was over here. What that would imply then is that the power spectrum on one side of the sky would look like different than the power spectrum on another side. So if I vary the baryon density, if the baryon density on one side of the sky takes on this value, and on the other side of the sky takes on this value, then the amplitude of temperature fluctuations on this side of the sky will be smaller than on this side of the sky. So here's my picture of what you would see. So the temperature fluctuations in this case might look very small over here, very big over here, moderate over here, small over here, et cetera, et cetera. So in other words, the amplitude of temperature fluctuations, again, would have a dependence on the location or direction of the sky. And this variation is also described by bipolar spherical harmonics. So there's a straightforward recipe to look for such variations. So one example of a spatial dependence of a cosmological parameter is a fine structure constant variation. So Chris Sigurdsson, who's a frequent visitor here, and I did this work with another collaborator, Kurilov, a while ago. So if the fine structure constant varies, then the visibility function varies and the CMB power spectrum varies. So again, functionally, what you would see are spatial modulations in the power spectrum. Another example is something that I worked out a little more recently with Dan Grin and Olivier Doré. And this was inspired by work by Pritchard and Gordon and also Holder, Nollet, and Van Engelen from a few years ago. And these guys pointed out something that I probably should have known, but in all the years of being a cosmologist, that it just never occurred to me. It's possible to have a compensated isocurvature perturbation. So suppose I have a universe that is completely smooth in terms of total matter density. So the gravitational potential is everywhere constant. The total energy density is everywhere constant. But suppose that there's a variation of the baryon density. So some region of the universe, the baryon density might be higher, and others it's lower, but it's compensated by a perturbation to the matter density that's low, where the baryon density is high, and vice versa, in such a way that the total matter density is perfectly constant. If I have such a compensated isocurvature perturbation, you can go through all the Boltzmann equations if you want. You can run CMB fast, or CAM, to check numerically. This primordial perturbation produces no temperature fluctuations at linear order in perturbation theory, zero. So it's plausible that there could be variations in the baryon to dark matter ratio as big as, you know, tens of percents in the primordial universe. But if you were to do that, then the adiabatic perturbations which we know to be there would have spatially varying cosmological parameters, and that would affect the CMB power spectrum. In some regions where the baryon density was low, the temperature fluctuation would be small. In some regions where the baryon density was big, spatial fluctuations would be big. And again, this is something that you can look for with bipolar spherical harmonics.
Doesn't that require quite a bit of fine-tuning in the mass scale of dark matter comparing mass scale? How they're produced in their universe?
So actually, I have been thinking and asking other people who are more effective model builders than I of some physical mechanism to give rise to that. It's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
It can be done with curviton models. There are ways to do this, to produce a compensated isocurvature perturbation with curviton models. I was looking at all these like asymmetric dark matter type models, or baryon symmetric baryogenesis models. That's extremely difficult to actually do. But it might be doable with a curviton. But again, for me, it's not a theoretical question, it's an empirical question. And this is something that we can address with measurement. And so one more thing with the CMB I want to tell you about is spatially varying cosmological birefringence. So I wrote this original cosmological birefringence paper in 1999 that predicted a uniform rotation of the CMB polarization. And then Pospilov, who's a frequent visitor here, and his collaborators, and a few other authors, then developed models in which the scalar field, the quintessence field that gives rise to this cosmological birefringence, since it has spatial fluctuations most generally, you would have spatial variations in the rotation angle. So now you would have a primordial polarization pattern that's purple, but now the rotation angle alpha might be different from one point in the sky to another, in which case the observed polarization pattern, the rotated one, the red lines, would have nothing to do with the primordial polarization pattern. And that would be bad because we are trying to learn something about primordial perturbations and cosmological parameters from the primordial polarization pattern. So again, if you take a primordial polarization pattern that's a realization of a Gaussian random field and rotate it everywhere, then the rotated pattern is no longer a Gaussian random field. There will be polarization equivalents of bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients induced, and by measuring those bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients, you can actually reconstruct alpha as a function of position on the sky. So in several papers, I and collaborators and several other people wrote down the minimum variance estimators, the optimal estimators for measuring a spatially varying alpha. And actually, Vera Gluschevich, who's the graduate student doing all the work, where is she, is now actually working with, working with Duncan Hansen, who's a certified CMB analysis expert, and me, who's not certified for anything, to actually look for this spatially varying rotation with WMAP data. So one thing that is kind of interesting is that all of the physics that I've told you about so far gives rise to bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients that have even parity. So weak lensing, departures from statistical isotropy, etc., all predict bipolar spherical harmonics that have capital L plus little l plus little l prime equal even. But there are Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that are non-zero for l plus l prime odd. And one can ask whether there are any physical mechanisms that would give rise to these odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics. Is there any value to look for these odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics? And this odd-even split for these bipolar spherical harmonics is analogous to the EB decomposition for CMB polarization. So, for example, weak gravitational lensing induces only even parity bipolar spherical harmonics, but that's only if the weak gravitational lensing is due to density perturbations. If you have primordial gravitational waves that lens the cosmic microwave background, those can produce odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics. And likewise, if I have measurements of both the even and odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics, I can look for cross correlations between them and therefore look in the temperature pattern for parity breaking effects. So I think that's what I'm saying here. you have a cross-correlation between the even and non-parity bipolar spherical harmonics, those would arise only if there's parity breaking. And one example of something that could induce such a parity breaking is a chiral gravitational wave background. So again, this is something that people here have worked on. There are theories for gravity in which the inflationary production of right-handed gravitational waves is different than that for left-handed gravitational waves. And so the primordial gravitational wave background that results after inflation is made up only of right-handed gravitational waves. So that's a parity-breaking gravitational wave background. That parity-breaking gravitational wave background does give rise to even and non-parity bipolar spherical harmonics. I'm going to come back to this in a second on the chalkboard, but first I'm going to tell you one more thing. There is also an odd parity bispectrum that you can look at. So you've probably all heard hundreds, if not thousands, of talks and seen and read hundreds, if not thousands, of papers. Some of you have maybe even written hundreds, if not thousands, of papers on non-Gaussianity from inflation. And there are equilateral models for the CMB bispectrum, for the primordial bispectrum. There are orthogonal models. There are topological defect models for the bispectrum. There's the local model, those squeeze models. What am I missing? There are lots of different models for what the CMB, what the primordial bispectrum could be in non-standard inflationary models. But all of those three-point functions predict a CMB bispectrum that is parity even. So all the predictions, all those models predict that the expectation value for the product of three ALMs will be non-zero only for L1 plus L2 plus L3 even. But you can also take the data and measure with the data expectation values for the product of three ALMs in which L1 plus L2 plus L3 sum up to an odd value. So there is an equivalently large space of odd parity bispectra that one can measure with a CMB bispectrum. And it's interesting to do this with the data. We have the data. We have codes that are measured to look for the CMB bispectrum. All you have to do is change one line, the line that says sum only over L1 plus L2 plus L3 even, so that sums only over L1 plus L2 plus L3 equal odd, and you can measure the odd parity CMB bispectrum. And for various reasons, if you actually find that it's non-zero, that's pretty spectacular. It turns out that there's no three-point correlation function for a density field that can be parity odd. But a two-dimensional bispectrum can be parity odd. Roughly speaking, the odd parity bispectrum does the following. So if I have a parity even bispectrum, what that says is that the correlation function or the expectation value for the temperature at 3 points that make up a triangle depends only on the shape of that triangle and not its orientation. And if I have a parity even bispectrum, what that says is that the three-point correlation function for this triangle is the same as the three-point correlation function for this mirror image of that triangle. So when I measure the parity even bispectrum, I'm summing over triangles that look like this and triangles that look like this. When I measure the odd parity bispectrum, I'm differencing between triangles that look like this and triangles that look like this. And the reason this can't exist in three dimensions is that if I take this particular triangle and then I rotate it, you know, in this direction, it's the same as this triangle over here. So in three dimensions, these two triangles are the same. In two dimensions, they can be distinguished. So that's why, if you were to actually measure a non-parity bispectrum in the CMB and find that it's non-zero, it would be pretty damn spectacular. It implies that we live in a preferred location in the universe and that there's parity breaking. So I now want to tell you about some more recent work that sort of develops or builds upon some of this stuff. So I'll move to this chalkboard over here. Can everybody see if I write on the chalkboard over here? Or should I? Oh, yeah, yeah, good idea. Yeah?
If you consider a triangle where the image is, you take the arrows and just pick the flow, that cannot be rotated to the original triangle, even in three dimensions.
oh, if I change the orientation of the arrows, that's true, but the arrows are kind of superfluous.
Right.
Because every Fourier mode in one direction has the same as a Fourier mode in the other direction. So let me go back two slides. Three slides. So what I told you is that we have these bipolar spherical harmonics. There are even and odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics. They are analogous to the EB decomposition of the CMB polarization. Roughly speaking, what you're doing with these bipolar spherical harmonics is looking for departures in the two-point correlation function from statistical isotropy, local departures. So if I have bipolar spherical harmonics that are non-zero, it could be that the two-point correlation function for these 2 points is different than the two-point correlation function for these 2 points. So it could be that the two-point correlation function is stretched out. So then when I look at the CMB temperature map, in some region of the sky, the hot and cold spots are elongated in some given direction. Okay. So the elongation of hot and cold spots can be described in much the same way as CMB polarization. So CMB polarization field is represented by a bunch of lines that point in a bunch of different directions. So heuristically, what these bipolar spherical harmonics do is they look at the hot and cold spots in the CMB and sort of figure out how the axes are aligned. So I can sort of represent the elongation of the two-point correlation function in the CMB with a bunch of polarization-like vectors. So this I write in terms of E and B, and this I write in terms of bipolar spherical harmonics, capital A, that can be even parity or odd parity. So likewise, if I look for, if I can, just as I measure an EB correlation to look for parity breaking with a CMB polarization map, I can also look for parity breaking by measuring a correlation between the even and odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics. So what I told you is that if I have lensing by density perturbations, that gives rise only to the even parity bipolar spherical harmonics. But if I have a primordial gravitational wave background, then that gives rise to both odd and even parity bipolar spherical harmonics. And if I have a chiral gravitational wave background, that gives rise to a cross correlation between the odd and even parity bipolar spherical harmonics that's not zero. And so the obvious question now is, suppose we had a gravitational wave background that had the largest possible amplitude, and suppose it was as chiral as it could possibly be. It was made entirely of right-handed gravitational waves. Is there any hope to actually detect this with weak gravitational lensing of the CMB? So you can do a calculation and then plot the result. And this is in the paper by Book, me, and Tarun Suradeep. And the plot in that paper shows you L to the sixth, C sub L, omega omega, which is the power spectrum for gravitational lensing by, this is the power spectrum for the curl component of gravitational, sorry, this is the power spectrum for, I should plot in this notation, for the odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics. So the power spectrum for the odd parity bipolar spherical harmonics falls pretty rapidly with L. And then you can calculate the noise with which you can measure this with a CMB map, the best possible CMB map, Planck plus. And it turns out that the noise power spectrum looks like this. And I'm not drawing any axes over here. This is logarithmic with lots of numbers. And so the bottom line is that, you know, you're several orders of magnitude away from detecting this chiral gravitational wave background via its lensing effects on the CMB, even in the best case scenario. Now, the problem with the CMB is that if I plot the CMB power spectrum, it has these familiar acoustic peaks, but then, as a function of log L, it decays exponentially at L's somewhere around 3,000. And that is due to silk damping, okay, the finite width of the surface of last scatter. So it turns out that the CMB can only be measured out to values of little L of about 3,000. What that means is that when I make my temperature map and look for these distortions to the two-point correlation function, I can only do so with some finite granularity. So roughly speaking, the number of pixels on the sky, the number of points in my map that I can use to look for these departures, from local departures from statistical isotropy, is roughly L max squared. And so when you follow through and actually calculate this signal to noise carefully, what you find is that that signal to noise scales with the, let me write it like this. So the signal to noise is about 4.5 times 10 to the minus 6 times L max and units of 1,000 squared. Now, in recent years, anyway, 4.5 times 10 to the minus 6 is a very small signal to noise, which is bad. Yeah?
So why just don't you detect this in EB?
Oh. Yes, you can try to look for it in EB. There are also cosmic variance limits there. But we're trying to figure out what these bipolar spherical harmonics are good for.
But I mean, you agree that at least for what you're discussing right now, EB is much more powerful than that A plus and A minus. Because I think kind of by construction, you can detect EB is just at the level of being detected.
It turns out that there's a very, very narrow range of gravitational wave amplitude over which EB is actually better. I can tell you about that later. And actually, no, I'm not thinking about EB. I'm just thinking about detection of this curl component. Okay?
I mean, just you would think that three-point function is harder than two-point function. So why? So if you can see the two-point function, why go into trouble?
Well, I'll show you in a second. So it turns out that this is all, from the point of view of the CMB, this is all formalism, academic. But when we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're looking at a surface of last scatter, spherical surface at a redshift of 1100. And we are mapping structure down to angular scales of about a tenth of a degree, which is shown here by the decay of the power spectrum at L greater than about 3,000. But between a redshift of 1100 and us, there is a long period in the history of the universe where the hydrogen is neutral. And there's also a long period of the universe where the hydrogen temperature is less than the temperature of the CMB, where the hydrogen gas cools more rapidly than the CMB. So if that happens, then that neutral hydrogen can be detected by absorption in the 21 centimeter line. And this is somewhat futuristic at this point, but people are actually talking about building low frequency radio telescopes to actually map the distribution of neutral hydrogen during the epoch of reionization. So you look out in the sky, you choose some particular frequency, and at some particular redshifted frequency, I'm looking at some gas at some particular redshift. And so now what I can do is look not at the CMB surface of last scatter, but do the same thing with these bipolar spherical harmonics, not with the temperature as a function of position in the sky, but with the 21 centimeter intensity as a function of position in the sky. And the advantage, in principle, is that if I plot the power spectrum for this 21 centimeter intensity, for example, at some redshift, say 50, so this is actually redshift 200 to about 30. So let's suppose we choose redshift of about 50, somewhere in the middle there. So suppose we measure the intensity of the hydrogen gas at redshift of 50 as a function of position in the sky. The power spectrum for this 21 centimeter intensity looks sort of like this. And the interesting feature here is that this cutoff, this L max, is somewhere around 10 to the 7th. So the CMB has finite angular scale structures. Smaller angular scale structures in the CMB are erased by the finite thickness of the surface of last scatter. It's not really a thickness. I mean, it's not actually a line. It's actually kind of thick. Whereas the 21 centimeter fluctuations are cut off only by the Jeans mass for the baryonic gas, which is extremely small. So if I'm going to try to look for these gravitational waves with these 21 centimeter intensity fluctuations instead of the temperature, then the signal to noise is more like 4.5 times 10 to the 3. L max divided by 3, 6. So I had 10 to the 3 over here. Yeah. 4.5 times 10 to the 6 L max divided by 10 to the 7. Actually, I...
Should the power be cubed then?
Oh. No, it's squared still. So I'm going to get there in a second. Yeah. So as Niyayesh pointed out, here I've made this measurement with just one surface of last scatter. But if I have this 21 centimeter radio telescope, by tuning the frequency of observation, I can actually make this map over many different surfaces of last scatter. And so at the end of the day, by co-adding the signal from all these different redshift slices, I can, in principle, add another factor of L max. And so when you actually do the calculation all the way through, the signal to noise turns out to be, taking into account the full three-dimensional information, or the roughly L max independent, statistically independent surfaces of last scatter, the signal to noise you can get to is about 6.8 times 10 to the 8th L max divided by 10 to the 7th. Or, in more familiar terms, what this implies is that if there's a gravitational wave background out there of some tensor to scalar ratio R, remember the current limit R is about 0.22, and next generation CMB polarization experiments are expected to get to about R of 10 to the minus 2. In principle, if you can map the neutral hydrogen distribution, then you could actually go to detect a value of R as small as about 10 to the minus 9, if you could actually make these maps out to L max 10 to the 7th. And it scales with L max cubed. So this is not something that's going to be done next year, probably not next decade, but in principle, it is possible, if we can map the neutral hydrogen distribution, to detect a gravitational wave background amplitude 7 orders of magnitude lower than what we do now. And then the last thing I want to tell you about very quickly, I'll go over here, is recent work that I finished with Dongqing Jiang. This was on the archive about a week or two ago. The title is Clustering Fossils from the Early Universe. And in this paper, we try to do something analogous to what we've done for the CMB. So if I have a three-dimensional distribution of mass, for example, from a galaxy survey, then I measure the fractional mass a three-dimensional field, which is the fractional density perturbation at position x. And then I Fourier transform it, right, in terms of Fourier coefficients delta of k. And if I have statistical isotropy and Gaussianity, then this is equal to a delta function that sets k equal to k prime times some power spectrum, three-dimensional power spectrum P of k. But all kinds of physical effects might modify this relation and give rise to departures from statistical isotropy. And so now, as one specific example, suppose that the primordial density perturbation comes from quantum fluctuations in the inflaton, but suppose that the inflaton is coupled to some other scalar field. If the inflaton is coupled to some other scalar field, then it's plausible that I could have two Fourier modes of the inflaton that are now coupled to a third mode of the scalar field that has a wave number capital K. So if I have some extra spectator scalar field during inflation that couples to the inflaton, so say phi squared sigma, then if the effects of sigma then disappear, it could leave an imprint as an off-diagonal correlation between different Fourier modes of the density field. So delta of k prime, in the presence of some other Fourier mode capital K, will be equal to a Dirac delta function that sets k plus k prime plus capital K equal to 0, times most generally some function f of k prime, times the amplitude of that particular scalar field mode. So h here is the amplitude of that particular scalar field mode, sigma of k. Maybe not. There's actually a paper by Baumann and Van Green that has a supersymmetric model that actually does this precisely.
Okay, it's supersymmetric, you can do it. Is there a protection of that potential in this direction?
Yeah. And if I had such a correlation, then what I can do is I can go to my density field, I can go to my galaxy survey, and I can consider every capital K mode individually. And then what I do is I look for correlations between all density perturbation modes that I observe, K prime, for all pairs of modes that sum up to this capital K. So if I have such an off-diagonal correlation, then what it says is the expectation value of delta of k prime for any two k primes that sum up to this capital K give me an estimator for the Fourier mode of this scalar field, which is otherwise unseen. And then what I can do is I can add the estimators for this Fourier mode from all these different triangles with inverse variance weighting, and therefore develop or write down the most general minimum variance estimator for sigma as a function of k. So I'm not going to go through the details, but in the paper, we write down a very, very straightforward recipe where we actually write down the optimal estimator for sigma as a function of k, and therefore we then follow on and write down the optimal estimator for sigma as a function of k. Another possibility, though, is that instead of having phi squared sigma, what if I had some coupling of the scalar field to a vector field, V? So in that case, I would have a correlation between two Fourier modes, K and K prime, with a Fourier mode capital K of the vector field. Now, a vector field differs from a scalar field because a vector field has a polarization. If this is a scalar field, and this I can't do very well, then all triangles that sum up to this particular Fourier mode, independent of the azimuthal angle, will give me the same off-diagonal two-point correlation. But if I have a vector mode propagating in this direction, then a triangle drawn in the chalkboard will have a different correlation with that Fourier mode than one drawn perpendicular to the chalkboard, and it'll have the opposite sign as one drawn on the other side. So a vector mode will have a similar estimator, but the correlation now will be described by some epsilon ij, k1i, k2j, where epsilon ij is a polarization tensor that describes the vector mode. And alternatively, if instead of d mu b nu, I had a correlation with some tensor perturbation. So this could be a gravitational wave mode, but most generally it's just some transverse traceless vector, transverse traceless tensor field. Then in that case, the dependence about this azimuthal angle would be cosine 2 pi. So the most general off-diagonal two-point correlation, delta of k prime, is written in terms of some functions of k and k prime times some polarization tensor epsilon pij. And what I've described so far is p equals scalar, p equals vector, but there are two vector transverse vector modes. And then there are also the two transverse traceless tensor modes. So the transverse traceless modes are the usual plus and cross. The two vector modes are can be aligned with the x-axis or y-axis. The Fourier mode is along the z-axis. And then it actually turns out that there are two scalar perturbations, two different scalar modes. The idea being that epsilon here, as written, is just the most general symmetric 3x3 matrix, which has six components. The most general 3x3 symmetric matrix can always be decomposed into two scalar modes, two vector modes, and two tensor modes. And so at the end of the day, what we've wound up doing is writing down minimum variance estimators that allow you to take a three-dimensional galaxy survey and look for evidence. It provides a very straightforward recipe for taking the galaxy survey and looking for distortions to the two-point correlation function that have scalar, vector, or tensor symmetry. So this gives you a way to look through your galaxy survey, Sloan, for example, to see or to look for evidence for coupling the scalar field to some other scalar, vector, or tensor field that then decays away. And I have, thanks to my collaborator, some pictures or movies. So I got movies. I don't know how instructive they are. I'll just show you the picture. Oops. So here, I imagine a Fourier mode propagating in the z direction. And this shows you the distortion to an otherwise spherically symmetric two-point correlation function that's due to a tensor perturbation with a plus polarization, tensor perturbation with the time x polarization, the two scalar modes, and then the two vector modes. So here, you've got the quadrupolar distortion of an otherwise spherically symmetric set of test masses that are familiar from gravitational wave detection. So as a gravitational wave propagates in this direction, I've got a sphere, I've got elongation in the y direction, sphere, and then elongation in the x direction. This is the same thing, but rotated by 45 degrees. The scalar mode induces just a scalar modulation of the total two-point correlation function. It just magnifies everything the same symmetrically. So this is analogous to detection of a scalar gravitational wave in scalar tensor theory's gravity. And then these are the two different vector modes. So vector perturbation, and likewise, if I had gravitational waves, if I had a vector mode of the gravitational wave, what that would do is induce quadrupolar distortions that are sort of like what you get for an ordinary gravitational wave. But in an ordinary gravitational wave, those distortions are transverse to the direction of propagation of the gravitational wave. If I were to have a vector-like gravitational wave, that would provide a quadrupolar distortion, but it would be aligned, that distortion be aligned 45 degrees off axis from the gravitational wave. And the other thing I can do then is also look for parity violation. So for gravitational, for the transverse traceless tensor components, I've got H plus and H cross, the two linear polarization states of the gravitational wave. But if I add them out of phase, then I get two polarization states for the gravitational wave that are right or left circularly polarized. So again, we provide in the paper a very well-defined algorithm for taking your galaxy survey and looking for evidence of parity breaking in the form of tensor perturbations that have right or left circular polarization. And likewise, for the two vector fields, for the two vector modes, you can also construct right and left circular polarized things. I thought I had a picture here, but I don't. So for the vector mode, for example, that elongation, you have the elongation everywhere, and it just rotates about the direction of propagation of the Fourier mode. So let me just show you one movie just so you see it. So this is a movie showing the right-handed circularly polarized tensor mode. So what you see is that you've got a quadrupolar distortion. It's always the sphere is always compressed as a pancake, but the orientation of the pancake rotates as I move up along the z direction. So that's the type of departure from statistical isotropy. Sorry, that's the type of distortion to the otherwise statistically isotropic two-point correlation function that these estimators that we wrote down are designed to look for. So I think I will simply conclude. So anyway, the conclusions are that you can measure the power spectrum. Lots of people measure the power spectrum of the CMB with galaxy surveys, but there's a lot more that can be done. And the other thing is, now that I've started working on a CMB analysis project with Vera and Duncan Hansen, the actual measurement is not that much more sophisticated algorithmically than what you do to measure a power spectrum. So if you have a galaxy survey, if you've got the data set, if you've got a CMB map, if you've got the data set, it's really not that much more work to actually look for all these things than the work that you're doing to measure the power spectrum anyway. So I think these are measurements that probably should be done. Okay, thank you very much.
Any questions for Mark?
Yep.
So you have a rapid diversity of things that can give you this median bipolar spectral balance. If you need a detection of your A plus, how easy is it to disentangle whether that detection is from lensing or patchy randomization or varying
by fringes? Patchy randomization does not do the A plus. Sorry, does not give the A mod, does not give the odd parity.
Right, but if you just had an even, you had a long list of things that
they
could
give
an
even.
If you just had the even, how easy is it to disentangle one source of even from another?
So there are two things that you could do. If it's patchy randomization, you could try to look for cross correlation with other tracers of the gas distribution, the ionization fraction, maybe from some future EOR type measurements. If you don't have that, then what you do is you measure the power spectrum for the bipolar spherical harmonic coefficients. So generally, the theories like patchy reionization, some specific model for patchy reionization, is going to make a prediction probably for A plus LM LL prime squared that depends on capital L and L and L prime. But it probably won't depend on capital M because capital M is the direction. So what you would do is you would measure the power spectrum for the biposh, and then presumably different theories like weak gravitational lensing, departures from statistical isotropy, patchy randomization, will make different predictions for this. It's the same way we distinguish between adiabatic and isocurvature perturbations with the CMB power spectrum.
Okay, so the shapes are rather different.
Yeah. Yep.
So if you do this, go through this procedure that you're describing, you're probably going to get a map, which is mostly noise, or any good things there. And then what are you going to do with it?
The noise?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're gonna make a map after this.
Uh-huh.
And this is exactly.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
So I didn't go to the next step. So what I said is this combining of all the different triangles that sum up to one different k,
yeah,
right, give you an estimator for sigma of k. That's almost certainly going to be noise dominated. But then what I do is I sum over all values of k, sum over all Fourier modes capital K that have roughly the same magnitude of sigma of k squared. And then this is going to give me an estimator for the power spectrum of sigma H or V. So what we actually do, this is an intermediate step on the way to a minimum variance estimator for the power spectrum for the scalar tensor or vector distortion to the otherwise to the two-point correlation function.
So isn't this basically some trial spectrum, with some rating?
Yeah. Yeah, so actually, what you're actually looking for is a four-point correlation function. And what we show here, so usually the thing that I like about this paper, apart from being like one of the few four-point correlation function papers I've actually read, is that the four-point correlation function is actually very, very complicated. So what I'm really doing when I write down this estimator for the power spectrum is I'm summing over all quadrilaterals, okay? So like this particular quadrilateral. And these four-point correlation functions get very complicated because with a statistical isotropy, a four-point correlation function depends on six parameters. And you can't think about a function of six parameters. But if you're just testing the null hypothesis of no distortions, then what you can do is just think about this four-point correlation function just as an off-diagonal correlation of two different Fourier modes. And when you do it that way, it's just easier to think about. And when you do it that way, then you can see that, you know, a four-point function for a scalar field will be the same for all quadrilaterals that contain these two triangles folded up in any different way, whereas the four-point function for quadrilaterals like this induced by a gravitational wave will have a cosine 2 phi dependence of on the angle phi between these two sides of the triangle. So it's an easier way to see what a four-point function is and how it depends geometrically on whether it's a scalar vector or tensor inducing it.
Any other questions? Let's thank Mark again.